This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.
Explosions rock the Ukrainian capital Kiev. Local officials say the blasts have caused deaths and injuries. Tehran slams some Western countries for urging Iran to exercise restraint towards rioters while allowing violent people to attack Iranian embassies. And Taiwan's president says a war with China is not an option, but she warns that the island will never give up its democratic way of life. Hello and welcome from our headquarters in Tehran. Thank you for joining us. My name is Gisumi Shahmadi, and these are our top stories this hour. Russia's military has struck Ukrainian cities, including Kiev, with at least 75 missiles in the first such strikes in months. Officials say that the blast caused at least 5 deaths and 12 injuries in the capital, but there is little detail about the casualties and injuries in other attacks that hit western and central cities. Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky is now accusing Russia of trying to wipe his country off the face of the earth. He says Russia is targeting Ukrainian people and energy infrastructure in these attacks. The strikes come 2 days after a deadly blast destroyed a bridge between Russia and Crimea. The road was a key supply link for Russian soldiers fighting in Ukraine. Russian President Vladimir Putin has blamed the Ukrainian Secret Service for the bridge attack. Meanwhile, our correspondent in Donetsk, Johnny Miller, joined us with more specifics about the missile strikes in Kiev and other Ukrainian cities.
This is the moment it looks like that Russia is upping or escalating its strikes in Ukraine, and indeed widening their parameters of what they see as legitimate targets. I've heard that some energy stations have been hit, and indeed we're still waiting to confirm what these strikes have hit in Kiev. We've been expecting this escalation for some time. Russia, indeed, a couple of days ago appointed a new general of the what they call the Special Military Operation. His nickname in military circles is the Cannibal, and he has a reputation for hardline military strategy. And of course, 2 days ago, we had the attack on the Kerch Bridge, and that was a moment that many expected that Russia after that, strike back hard on Ukraine. And I think that's what we're seeing right now in Kiev and other cities. And I've mentioned often that we are expecting at some point Russia to start widening its attacks. We thought this moment could have come much earlier, perhaps when Ukraine struck the Russian Federation territory, or when they attacked Crimea. So we've been expecting Russia to widen its attacks. Indeed, many of the hardliners in Russia have been calling for Putin to step up these attacks for some time.
Iran has slammed the meddlesome comments by the U.S. and some European governments about the recent riots in the country and the double standards that they apply to human rights. Foreign Ministry spokesman Nasser Kanani says that the Western governments say Iran must show restraint towards people who engage in violent and undermine its security. And Kanani says that the same governments have allowed violent people to attack Iranian embassies in Europe. He says those who lecture Iran on how to treat its citizens should not allow a knife-wielding man to attempt to attack an Iranian ambassador. This was in reference to the recent attacks on the Iranian embassy in the Danish capital, Copenhagen. Over the past weeks, Iranian missions in other European countries, including the UK and Norway, have also come under assault. Iran has hosted transport ministers from 5 Central Asian countries for talks on new transit policies aimed at boosting cooperation among the participating states. Yusuf Jaladi reports.
A new transit map is being charted here. Transport ministers from Iran and 5 Central Asian countries, including Turkmenistan, Kazakhstan, and Kyrgyzstan, are in Tehran, attending the first Transit Cooperation Summit.
This summit is held on the initiative of the Islamic Republic. Regarding the political atmosphere of our region, transit is of major significance. More efficient transport policies are decisive for the development of countries, especially when it comes to import and export.
Our colleagues will work within the next 2 weeks to draw up a joint document that will lay out the roadmap for improving and increasing the level of our country's transit cooperation.
To facilitate border traffic, the participating countries agreed to digitalize transit processes, facilitate embassy affairs and visa issuance, especially for transit drivers, and improve tariffs and transit charges. More countries, including Russia and Azerbaijan, are also set to join the initiative.
We are talking to the honorable ministers of Russia and Azerbaijan to remove the obstacles and help engage in more transit cooperation.
Iran is situated on a geopolitically important region, connecting the Indian Ocean and the Persian Gulf in its south to the Caspian Sea in its north. The country is already party to the International North-South Transport Corridor, which is a 7,200-kilometer-long multimode network of ship for moving freight between India, Iran, Azerbaijan, Russia, Central Asia, and Europe.
This is an all-win step for all sides of the bargain here, because the landlocked Central Asian states will no longer have to worry about accessing the global transit network. And by doing this, Iran will turn into a transit hub in the region, pushing its annual transport volume to over 20 million tons. Yusuf Jalali, Tehran.
Taiwan's president is striking a conciliatory tone towards Beijing. Tsai Ing-wen says that the war between the island and China is absolutely not an option. She says that her government is willing to talk with Beijing and is looking forward to constructive interaction if possible, if China respects what she called Taiwan's people's commitment to their sovereignty, democracy, and freedom. Tsai also accused China of intimidation against Taiwan and threatening regional peace. China has recently increased its military activities near the island. Beijing says it is ready to use force to make sure Taiwan remains part of its territory. China is also angered by the military ties between Taiwan and the U.S. and has warned Washington against intervention in the region. North Korea's leader Kim Jong-un has personally guided and overseen recent exercises involving ballistic missiles by the country's nuclear tactical operation units. The state news agency says missile launches with mock nuclear warheads were in response to large-scale joint Navy drills by South Korea and the United States. It says that Pyongyang wanted to demonstrate its readiness to hit and destroy enemy targets, including airfields and key posts, in any time from any location. Kim has also been quoted as saying that he would boost the country's military might and that Pyongyang does not need any dialogue with adversaries. The country has launched 7 missiles in the last 2 weeks, including the one passing through Japan's airspace. The North says that its launches are necessary countermeasures as it considers joint war games by the U.S., Japan, and South Korea a rehearsal for invasion. The U.S. calls it a new strategy of high-tech containment, but in essence, it is an effort to prevent China from advancing. In other words, a technological blockade. That is the U.S.'s way of flexing its muscle, similar to the way it imposes sanctions. And instead of welcoming competition, the U.S. is doing it all it can to stop China. The product the U.S. is targeting now is chips, and not, of course, the edible one.
In the mid-90s, the U.S. was involved in the Cold War with the Soviet Union, but that was a nuclear arms race. Now, however, Washington is fighting another Cold War, with China this time, and in the digital space, a fight for technological superiority. In late August 2022, Washington restricted sales of high-end and sophisticated chips to China and Russia. Top chip designers based in the US have even reported that they have been told to limit sales of their high-end chips. One of the manufacturers, NVIDIA, one of the largest graphical process unit makers in the world, has even revealed through an SEC filing that Washington fears there is a risk that the products may be used militarily in China and Russia. The US says the restrictions are aimed at keeping advanced technologies out of the wrong hands. Meanwhile, China has slammed the restrictions, stating that the US is trying to impose a technological blockade. Beijing added that Washington aims to maintain its technological hegemony through the latest restrictions. The latest round of tensions between China and the US could also present an explanation for Washington's increasing interest in Taiwan. The Biden administration has so far tried to further strengthen its ties with Taiwan, and this has been clearly demonstrated in many cases, the two most notable being top US officials traveling there and Washington offering billions in subsidies to a Taiwanese company if it stops selling its advanced semiconductor chips to China. Taiwan Semiconductor Manufacturing Company, or TSMC, is the largest and most advanced chip manufacturing factory in the world. And Biden's push to stop the sales to Beijing only proves the US's aims that it seeks to impose a technological blockade and maintain or even strengthen its hegemony.
Chips and semiconductors are essential to current technology, including computers, military equipment, nuclear reactors, and weapons, and that is why the U.S. is targeting chips so that it can prevent China from advancing. But this is a form of economic and technological terrorism. The U.S. wants to cut China's access to certain semiconductor chips made anywhere in the world with U.S. tools.
The host of measures that Washington is taking to stop Beijing from getting its hands on high-end technology could amount to the biggest shift in U.S. policy on shipping technology to China since the 1990s. The expansion of U.S. powers to control exports of chips made with U.S. tools to China is based on a broadening of the so-called Foreign Direct Product Rule. This is the same principle that gave the U.S. authority to control the export of chips made overseas to Chinese telecoms giant Huawei Technologies, and later to stop the flow of semiconductors to Russia. But the question is whether this will be effective or will it backfire, similar to many other unilateral measures that the US has taken over the past years. Some experts say Washington's move will set the Chinese back. But some, including top American officials in the U.S., say the unilateral controls being put into place will lose effectiveness over time, and the effort could backfire if other countries don't join Washington. The most recent U.S. blockade is aimed at preventing technology from being used by America's military rival. But these chips have a wide range of applications. Even if the blockade ends up being as effective as the U.S. wants it to be, it is only a matter of time before China begins manufacturing its own high-end chipsets, as well as semiconductors, and eventually becoming self-reliant.
A landslide in central Venezuela has left at least 25 people dead and more than 50 others missing. The tragedy happened near the capital, Caracas, after heavy rain since the early hours of Thursday caused the river to overflow. The flooding has caused enormous damage to infrastructure, with some areas reporting power cuts due to fallen trees. Authorities say around 1,000 people have joined the rescue efforts and are searching for the missing people. The landslide is set to be the biggest in 3 decades and the worst so far this year. In 1991, huge landslides killed some 10,000 people in the state of Vargas, north of Caracas. People in Pakistan are joining fellow Muslims in other countries to celebrate the birth anniversary of Prophet Muhammad. The occasion was marked by a host of events, including processions in the capital, Islamabad. Nasser Kazmi reports.
Thousands of Muslims have held a gathering in Pakistani capital Islamabad to celebrate the birth anniversary of Islam's holy Prophet Muhammad.
The occasion is one of the key festivities on the Islamic calendar and holds a special significance for the Muslims around the world. The same goes for the people of Pakistan, who are always excited about commemorating this day.
The participants in the ceremonies say that the day provides Muslims with a great opportunity to understand the teachings and the message of Prophet Muhammad.
Prophet's teachings are still resonant in the society. This is a time to remember and follow the teachings of our Prophet and his family, who dedicated their lives for the great cause of Islam.
This day reminds us of the message of the Holy Prophet. He teaches us to forget our differences and live in peace and harmony with a sense of brotherhood.
In Islamabad, many of the public and private buildings, as well as streets, markets, and mosques, are decorated with buntings and illuminated to mark the auspicious occasion. Nasser Kazmi in Islamabad.
And that brings us to the end of this edition of World News. Stay tuned.
A diverse range of programs. Spirituality. Youth. Eastern Tales. Roundtable discussions. Culture. Politics. All produced by IRIB English Radio. Under the starry sky of the desert, from the very heart of evergreen forests, with the radiance of silver-colored sand, in the midst of proud mountains, closer, Iran, a
Hello. I am Mitra, an Iranian nature traveler. To know more about the wonders and beauties of magnificent Iran, keep me company. Watching a rainbow in the sky is beautiful, but the idea of watching a rainbow in the mountains seems to be fictional. However, this fantasy becomes so real when you describe this phenomenon in geology. Tomorrow, I'll take a trip to Hormuz Island to watch this awesome, colorful landscape, which is known as the Rainbow Valley. Hormuz Island, which is located in the Persian Gulf, has an area of 42 square kilometers. This great Iranian island is home to one of the wonders of nature called the Rainbow Valley. The Rainbow Valley, which is located southwest of the island, is a narrow valley with multicolored soil surrounded by colorful mountains. It is painted with more than 70 colors and a variety of stones and minerals, which make this place an interesting destination for geologists. The minerals include black, white, and gray dolomites, pyrite, gypsum, anhydrite, apatite, and iron oxides. The color of the soil ranges from white, yellow, red, green, orange, beige, to brown, light turquoise, and even gold. The yellow, red, silver, and black colors are mainly of clay and iron oxide compounds, while the white, blue, pink, and gray are made of volcanic compounds. I am now on a passenger boat. It's about 40 minutes from Haqqani Port in Bandar Abbas to Hormuz Island. I'm so excited to see this attraction. Just imagine, so many colors on the earth. Looks like a colorful Persian carpet. Amazing! Well, I am now in Hormuz Island. The beauties of this island are not few. The mountains surrounding the valley are so beautiful. Oh, look, a yellow-colored rock with red, blue, and pink pieces of a stone around it. Very interesting. What doubles the beauty of the Rainbow Valley is the blue sky and the vast Persian Gulf. There are different colors here, but the red color has more share in this rainbow. Oh, masterpiece of nature. Extraordinary, you can't believe it. Well, I can't take my eyes off all these beauties. It's a really different experience. You have to see here yourself. Oh, look at there. Local women who are wearing traditional clothes are selling handicrafts. Let me see. A shellfish necklace. Yes, I want this. Actually, I don't like to leave this island, but I have to. This island is so special. Listen, sound of waves, seagulls. Oh, it's like a new birth. So, let me take a walk on the shore before leaving this island. Until next time, goodbye.
Our voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran. What you heard was an IRIB English radio program.
Joining us now from Ontario, Canada.
Now back to our story.
What is it in there?
We will be talking about this.
Let me bring in Leo Sazdi. He's a professor of international.
The Spotlight.
A brazen attack has occurred in which an Israeli soldier, as a result, was killed in Al-Quds. This occurred after four Palestinians were shot dead in an Israeli raid in the occupied West Bank. Now, whether these incidents are related remains to be seen, but at this point it shows that when a Palestinian wants to act against Israeli forces, it can do so, aside from this being a reaction due to Israeli repression. In this edition of The Spotlight, we will look at why the Israeli-Palestinian conflict remains at the heart of the decades-old conflict in West Asia, and how Israel continues its flagrant violations of Palestinians. First, let's cross on over to occupied Ramallah and talk to Mona Kandil about what has occurred. Mona, at this point, tell us the numbers that have been injured, both on the Palestinian side or killed, and also on the Israeli side, and where things stand at this point.
Well, we have to mention that the manhunt for the Palestinian man, or the suspect, Israeli state, who is behind the shooting, is still underway. Yesterday, a Palestinian get out of a vehicle at a military checkpoint at the entrance to Shafat refugee camp in Al-Quds and opened fire at the Israeli soldiers stationing there, killing an Israeli female soldier and wounding others. At least two are in serious condition. The Israelis claimed that the man the identity of the man was revealed from the Shafat refugee camp. The Israeli soldiers succeeded, unfortunately, to arrest four Palestinians. One of them is the brother of this man who carried out the shooting, as the Israeli military is saying. Both, all the four Palestinians who were arrested denied any information. They say that they didn't know that the man would be carrying out a shooting. They said that they stopped the vehicle at the checkpoint. He'd get out of the vehicle and opened fire. All the entrances, we have to say, leading to Shafat refugee camp were completely closed by the Israeli forces. More Israeli soldiers were sent there. Clashes have taken place between Palestinian residents of the Shafat refugee camp as well as the residents of Anata, the nearby Palestinian town, with the Israeli soldiers. Up till the moment, the manhunt is underway, and the entrances to Shafat refugee camp and Anata town are completely closed. A number of Palestinian groups said that they are responsible for the shooting, but at the same time, experts and the Israeli military believe that this man carried out the shooting by himself, and they know that he was not affiliated to any of the Palestinian resistance groups.
Thank you very much for that. We appreciate it. Mona Kandil there from Occupied Ramallah. Thank you.
This is The Spotlight. The Spotlight takes an in-depth look at the headlines, featuring interviews with well-known guests from diverse backgrounds to get to the bottom of the story. You can listen to The Spotlight every day on IRIB English Radio.
Now let me introduce our guest for this edition of the program. Moti Abu Musaba is a Palestinian political activist and joins us from Gaza City. Also joining us is Mick Napier, Scottish-Palestine Solidarity Campaign, who joins us from Edinburgh. Gentlemen, welcome to you both. Let me first get an idea from you, Mick Napier, about what has occurred. I mean, we're looking at a brazen attack, the person who decided to do this, which is said to be a revenge attack. It's almost confirmed. A correspondent also confirmed that, where an Israeli soldier was killed. The fact that this person took matters into his hands and went out and did this obviously is one side of the story, but the reasons as to why this has occurred is where we'd like to get a reaction from you on this.
Well, reasons work at several different levels. When we talk about a revenge attack, Israel has been on a killing spree. And it believes that it can kill. It's been young teenagers recently they've been focusing on, quite a few of them children. But Israel believes that it can kill these Palestinians with relative impunity in the West Bank, because they have saturated the area with soldiers, with the world's most advanced surveillance equipment. And therefore they think that the Palestinians are, to use the disgusting language of an earlier Israeli general, are like drugged cockroaches in a bottle, which is what they thought they could reduce the Palestinians to. But they're not drugged and they're not cockroaches. And it's very difficult for the Israelis to cope with the kind of resistance which we've just seen, where a heroic young man, possibly not connected to any other resistance groups, but certainly, I would imagine, influenced by the current developments and changes in tactics of those resistance groups, the resurgence, not just in Jenin, but spilling over into other areas in the West Bank. He couldn't help but be lifted by this. And the fact that he's been able, nonchalantly, you would almost imagine that he was trained militarily, but that he could emerge from a car and inflict such damage on this massively highly equipped army, which has been terrorizing the West Bank successfully to a degree for a very long time, is quite remarkable. Quite remarkable. And you have to explain it, not just in terms of whether he himself has suffered family members killed or brutalization. This is the small change of life in the West Bank. But whether he feels that the alternative is simply doom, not just for him personally, but for the Palestinian people. Because the Israelis make no secret that their plan is a Palestine without Palestinians. And therefore, given the lack of any alternative to resistance other than humiliation and degradation, increasing numbers of people are choosing the route of armed resistance. How that will go, it's impossible from my armchair to predict, but it's certainly a devastating surprise for the Israelis that Palestinians, after everything they've been through, still resist, and so successfully.
The point that our guest there from Edinburgh makes, Moti Abu Musab, is a very important one, I think. And I'm wondering what you think about that, and that is the fact that you have somebody that is not related to any particular resistance group, but is a lone person who has decided to react based on the fact that Israel has killed Palestinians and carried out the operation. And that's quite remarkable, because many are now subscribing to that method. Do you think that this is something that is going to keep on increasing as time goes by?
First of all, thanks for having me. It's my pleasure to join you once again. In fact, there is, I think, a wide consensus that the resistance actions against the Israeli occupation in the recent days actually are remarkably increasing. And in my opinion, there are many, there are multiple reasons behind that. The first one is the ongoing and the relentless Israeli suppression and aggression practice against the Palestinians in the West Bank. Today, as you know, the bloodshedding of the Palestinians there is continued since the beginning of this year, as you have mentioned, that since the beginning of this year, 2022, more than 100 Palestinians were killed and murdered by the Israeli occupation in front of the whole world. Needless to mention, the ongoing raids and the continuous storming of Palestinian cities and villages in the West Bank, especially in Nablus and Jenin City, actually this goes hand in hand with the deteriorating situation of the economic conditions and the humanitarian conditions. According to the latest records, the unemployment rate actually surpasses 70% among the Palestinian youths there. So this actually ignites the tension on the West Bank. Actually, let's be clear that on the other hand, beside that, or in addition to that, Israel deliberately tries to build more and more settlement. Israel tries to create a new de facto on the ground. There is some important an important issue and important reason behind that, which is the ongoing Israeli violations practiced in Al-Aqsa Yards, which actually, as you know, adds fuel to the fire in the West Bank, because the Palestinian people there are watching the Israeli provocations against the Palestinian citizens, against the Palestinian women and elderly there, which actually adds fuel to the fire and increase the tension among those youths. So amid all those provocations, amid all those attacks and aggressions, the Palestinian people have no choice but to resist the Israeli occupation and to defend themselves.
Indeed, those are some very good points that you make in terms of the right to react there. But, you know, what is somewhat interesting here is how the interpretation is made, McNabb here, when it comes to the way Israel describes the situation. In this case, in point, the Israeli military says that it opens fire only when it's in life-threatening situations. That kind of brings back the explanation given during the last war, where you have the U.S. and the EU come out and say Israel has the right to defend itself. Isn't that code for Israel to shoot and kill?
Of course. And not only will the green light be shone from Washington or Berlin or London, but they will also supply the means for the killing. Look, Israel is very adept at propaganda. It doesn't seem to work with a great majority of people in Europe, actually, but they're still very adept at it. Israel has been caught officers killing children. I myself spoke to the father of a 13-year-old schoolgirl, quite famous was the case, Iman al-Hams, because of an accident recording the soldiers talking. And the officer told his soldiers to kill anything in the area, even if it was 3 years old. And that was played on Israeli television. And I was looking through some old anniversaries yesterday and came upon the example, I was shocked, but I don't know why, of the Israeli general who found a group of Egyptians during one of the wars. And they were captives, they were quarry workers, they were not soldiers, they were completely unarmed. And the story is not that he killed all of them, he did, he slaughtered these civilians, but that much later he boasted about it in the Israeli media. And there was no backlash, there were no charges, no investigation. So if you murder civilians, Egyptian or Palestinian, Lebanese or whatever, and then boast about what you have done in Israel, You can do this with complete impunity. So the Americans have an intelligence agency, so do the British. It's not that they don't know. They know exactly the barbarity of the Israelis. They know this because they've studied it. And for a very short time, the British were on the receiving end of it, very short before they restructured the alliance. So they know exactly what Israel's doing in terms of killing children, deliberately killing children. There have been UN reports in the last couple of years, which say very clearly, Israel is indiscriminately killing civilians in Gaza at that time, and is indiscriminately killing children. During the Great March of Return, the UN reported that Israel was killing journalists, medical workers, and children, and it said, knowing that they were children and knowing who they were. So there's no secret. You don't have to be a radical or a dissident to... Anybody who wants to find out can find this out from unimpeachable resources. Sure. What the Palestinians live under is a most barbaric and murderous regime. And that explains one thing. People under colonial domination, the naked violence, let's say, which what colonialism is, many people just try to live, you know. They don't want to fight. There's a minority who want to fight. There's a minority who want to collaborate always. But most people in the middle just try to feed their families and live and put up with some humiliation. But they begin to resist in the mass when they realize that they cannot live in this way, that the Israelis will not allow them to live in this way, that the humiliation and the killings will be incessant and will increase until Palestinians are driven out. So we can look at the tactics of the resistance. They're very impressive. They're changing in a way that they've evolved tactics which are keeping the Israelis wrong-footed. But the rising resistance can be laid at the door, one, of the Israelis, and two, of the indomitable Palestinian ability to absorb tremendous punishment and still continue to resist. Can I just add one thing?
Go ahead.
100 Palestinians killed, and they've managed to kill, I think, 19 or 20 Israelis. Now, that's horrible, and I don't want to sound callous. But, you know, normally in an anti-colonial resistance, it can be 100 to 1. In Vietnam, it was 60 to 1. You know, in Algeria, it was roughly 100 Algerians killed for every French occupier. So what the Palestinian resistance is achieving at very high cost, I don't want to minimize the cost, is quite remarkable.
Yeah, you both have talked about this figure, which is accurate in terms of 100 being killed. And what is really, really sad about this figure, that this is five times as many Palestinians that have been killed in the same period in 2021, where we mentioned 100. So bad that the UN Human Rights Chief Michel Bachelet has expressed alarm at the high number of Palestinians, including children, that have been killed and or injured in the occupied Palestinian territory this year. Mutab Musab, why do you think that Israel has put his killing machine, as some call it, in high gear this year?
Yes, as you know, that the Israeli occupation forces are trying to impose a new de facto on the ground. They are racing counter the clock to impose the new realities on the ground, to seize more Palestinian lands, armed with the open American support and the abhorrent silence of the international community towards those crimes. So Israel, as good as possible, tries to suppress more Palestinians, to steal more Palestinian lands. Trying to exploit the tumultuous region and the instability and the global fronts, especially with regard to the Ukrainian and Russian crisis nowadays. But anyway, as you know, that Palestinians would never allow the Israelis and the Israeli occupation to keep committing its crimes without any punishment or without any response. And actually, what is going on the ground with this regard actually reveals the hypocrisy of the international community and the U.S. administration that speaks up when it comes to the Ukrainian issue, when it comes to the Ukrainian regions annexed by the Russian forces and the Russian government. They are speaking up and trying to denounce that kind of annexation. But when it comes to the Palestinian people, we are witnessing how the Israeli occupation forces are annexing the Palestinian or have been annexing the Palestinian lands for more than seven decades without having any response from the international community or the U.S. administration. Actually, this reveals clearly how hypocrite and how biased the international community to the Israeli occupation at the expense of the Palestinian people. Today, the Palestinian people, amid all that kind of bias, have no choice but to resist the Israeli occupation and to prevent the Israeli occupation from committing its crimes.
Well, this is the problem here, McNabb, here, that I see it being a problem of perception, that the Israelis, backed by their media conglomerates that they control, always paint the picture that they are being the victim. For example, if you have a Palestinian that attacks them, that Palestinian is called a terrorist. But when you have one of their security sources or forces, kill a Palestinian, then they're defending Israel's security. Our guests have talked about the Ukraine conflict. Again, a matter of perception. Who's being the aggressor there? Is Russia being the aggressor, or are they being the ones that were being provoked and being cornered after 6 years of a war, for example? And I'm using that just as a comparative analysis there. This view of the perception is what we're looking at. But do you think slowly but surely Israel is losing that battle because so many people are becoming aware of the Palestinian cause?
No, I don't think that Israel is slowly losing the battle. I don't think so at all. I think if you study the numbers, polls commissioned by the European Union, recent polls in America, for that matter, in the last few weeks, Israel long ago lost the battle for public opinion. And it's very important to note that. It's not what I want to believe, it's what anybody who looks at the results of public opinion studies must conclude, that by their resistance, Palestinians have been able to defeat Israel in the court of public opinion. Now, I don't mean in terms of what's allowed to be discussed publicly in Britain or Germany or America. That's a different matter. I have spent years in court on criminal charges for Palestine advocacy. There's an attempt to silence people here, just as there is to call human rights groups in the West Bank terrorist groups. Israel does it there. Our governments do it here. But in terms of what people believe, they already are deeply suspicious of Israel. An opinion poll after opinion poll shows that Israel is deeply unpopular, viewed as sinister, viewed as a thug and a bully by popular opinion. Now, that needs to be translated into active energy, boycott, divestment, and sanctions around the world, but that's the reality we start with. So I don't think Israel's slowly losing it. It's very important to understand they lost it a long time ago, and they have never recovered public support. It's gone completely.
Okay, we need to talk about the Islamic Jihad, and they actually have supported what has happened because of the bravery of the person that came out and did this. So my question to you, Mufti Abu Musabbeh, was there was just the founding anniversary that was held a few days back in Gaza by the Islamic Jihad, and on display were some new military equipment and some other various forms of military equipment in addition to the new ones. Are we looking at Israel taking note of the Islamic Jihad, its strength that's been elevated, increased compared to the past, including other resistance groups like Hamas, and seeing that, you know, they are not at a strong point when it comes to the armed aspect, when it comes to, for example, resistance groups vis-a-vis Israel and their forces?
Yes, as you know that today the Palestinian resistance factions actually are standing united in the front of the Israeli occupation, and they are races counter the clock to develop their abilities and to enhance their abilities to confront the Israeli occupation crimes. Today it's just a matter of time for any kind of escalation to break out between the Palestinian resistance factions and the Israeli occupation forces, especially amid the ongoing and the relentless Israeli crimes and violations, which actually makes any kind of a new escalation or a new round of escalation is so close. So amid all these conditions, the Palestinian resistance factions, especially or led by Hamas movement and the Islamic Jihad, are obliged to be united in front of the Israeli occupation to have a strong unity. We as Palestinians realize that we cannot face the Israeli occupation separately, okay, or divided. The strategic choice we have here is to keep maintaining our unity in front of the Israeli occupation, sure, and to develop our abilities to confront the Israeli occupation forces.
Last question, quickly, if you can, McNapier. I thought this was a very important point made, where Palestinian security forces said the military raids that Israel does, in conjunction with them, actually undermine their credibility and public support, especially in the absence of a political process, which is non-existence. I think that was a very interesting point. Are we looking at any chance of political process anytime soon?
Impossible, because the Israelis have never been willing to enter a genuine political process. They believe in technical superiority, technological, military arms mean that they don't need to negotiate with the Palestinians. They can simply control them prior to removing them. The PA has passed its sell-by date. If it had a sell-by date, it should simply disappear. It's an agent of the Israeli occupation, and the rising resistance levels in the West Bank make their future very, sure, very uncertain indeed.
Thank you for that. Sorry, we're fresh out of time. That's McNapier there, Scottish-Palestine Solidarity Campaign. Thank you. Mufti Abu Musabbeh, a pleasure. Palestinian political activist from Gaza City. Thank you so much. And we had Mona Kandil at the top of the hour, of course, Mona from Ramallah. With that, we come to an end for this edition of The Spotlight from Mikova Tavway and the team. It's goodbye until next time.
What you heard was an IRIB English radio program. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
Questions and answers on Islamic beliefs.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuhu, dear listeners of IRIB English Radio. This is your host Musa al-Bahadili, and you are now listening to the program Q&A on Islamic Beliefs. Joining us in the studio today is a dear friend and esteemed guest, Sheikh Nur Muhammad, who is an Islamic researcher at the Seminary of Qum. Dear Sheikh, I welcome you, and of course, assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullah.
Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullah. Thank you for having me.
Thank you for joining us, dear Sheikh. Dear Sheikh, our topic today is unfortunately what has become a sensitive topic, a sensitive discussion as well, subject of discussion, I apologize. In our Islamic, Shia Islamic communities as well. And that is about the whole unity of Islam. And when I say unity of Islam, we're going to be very specific because we do not want any misconceptions to arise and misunderstandings. Islamic unity between the Shia school of thought and the Sunni school of thought. Because in Islam, we believe in that we must be united against our enemies. We must stand as one, as brothers in faith, even though there are some differences in our rulings, jurisprudential rulings, and also in our beliefs. But at the end of the day, we believe in the same God and the same messenger. Does that then mean that for us Shia Muslims that we have to not, how should we say this, speak about our beliefs? Does this mean that we should not preach some of our beliefs? Does this, for example, mean that if we are in a mosque and the imam of the mosque is a Sunni, does this then mean that it's wajib, obligatory for us to pray behind this imam? Because seemingly it would seem that what we are doing, us Shia Muslims, what we are sacrificing for this Islamic unity is perhaps a lot more than what others are sacrificing for this Islamic unity, to the extent that we are neglecting perhaps or omitting to mention our core beliefs that make us who we are. So, dear Sheikh, how important is this Islamic unity, and does it justify, in essence, changing our Shia Islamic identity?
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. You know that about Islamic unity, we have a lot of emphasis from Ahlul Bayt alayhim salatu wassalam about maintaining this Islamic unity among our brothers and sisters. First of all, I need to start by some of the points which are very necessary for understanding this Islamic unity. First of all, we have a lot of commonalities within Islamic denominations. Why we do not focus on those huge amounts of commonality between us? For example, about the unity of Allah, Tawheed, about Nubuwwah of Noble Prophet Muhammad, peace and blessing of Allah be upon him and his pure progeny, about Noble Quran. All Islamic denominations, we have Noble Quran, Noble Prophet Muhammad, Tawheed, about the one Qibla that we pray toward,
so
that.
So many beliefs.
Many, many. Even if you go to the Islamic laws, Islamic jurisprudence, we have a lot of commonality. For those people, you know, because I have spent some years for Islamic jurisprudence, I know that. So we have a lot of commonalities in different books of jurisprudence with Ahlul Sunnah, our brothers and sisters in faith.
Even Islamic rulings.
Yes, but unfortunately, we want to go to the differences. Why
emphasize the differences between us.
Why? This is a big question. Why we have this problem? You know that Islamic unity with our dear brothers and sisters, it means that, first of all, it is within Islamic orders. I want to say that if you go to the verses of Noble Quran and to the narrations of Ahlul Bayt, you find a lot of emphasis and encouragement on the side of Ahlul Bayt to maintain our relationship and unity with our dear esteemed brothers and sisters in Islam, other denominations of Islam. And Ahlul Bayt, Noble Prophet Muhammad, they asked us and ordered us to maintain this unity with our brothers and sisters. And I'm sure that unfortunately some of our dear